Hi, Bill.
Hi, Con. Welcome back.
Always good to be back.
Normally, we have Matt Lewis on. Matt Lewis, I believe, is traveling today. But he should be back next week. Last time you were on, Con, which was not all that long ago.
Not all that long ago. It's good to be back so soon.
I know. We made a bet last time.
That's true.
Whether or not the Senate would have a CBO score before a vote on the final bill.
Right, an official CBO score, not a preliminary analysis.
Right, the full score. And the New York Times website actually took out that segment of us and put it up. So there are more witnesses than usual. how do you feel about the bet right now? How you think you're doing?
I think I'm doing pretty well. I don't think we're even going to see a vote until January 2010 at least.
Well, that's not the bet. The bet
no,
is
that's not the bet.
Score.
But the more it gets pushed back, the more incentive Harry Reid has to have a little chicanery. So we'll see. We'll see.
You cling to that hope. The bet is dinner in D.C., and my tummy is hungry.
Dinner in D.C., that's true.
But this is the Week in Blog, our weekly segment, our roundup of what's percolating in the blogosphere and how it is influencing the political discourse. I think for the most part, this is election week. Much election-related commentary about the races in upstate New York, New Jersey, and Virginia, and elsewhere. Con, what is the talk in the conservative blogosphere after the results on Tuesday?
Everyone is very happy they lost in New York 23. No, seriously.
That's a conservative victory, I understand.
Yes. Well, let's start at the top. We got Eric Erickson had a post up right away. I mean, we're talking results are in, Hoffman loses, Eric's got a post up. In New York 23, conservatives win. There are two big victories at work in New York's 23rd Congressional District. First, the GOP now must recognize it will either lose without conservatives or will win with conservatives. And secondly, and just importantly, there has all of a sudden been a huge movement among some activists to go the third-party route. We see in New York 23 that is simply not possible. Third parties are not viable.
Who was saying that at the Red State?
This was Eric Erickson, the editor of Red State. So,
now Red State was supportive of the Hoffman candidacy, correct?
Very, very much so.
Was he backtracking?
No, not at all. He's saying that when I first read the post, I was like, oh my god, that's such silly spin. They lost, and it's true that everyone in Red State, everyone in the conservative blogs was definitely disappointed. That Hoffman loss, that's unavoidable. It was definitely a disappointment. But when you step back and look at what the purpose of the Hoffman challenge was, you see that their goals were largely accomplished. As silly it may sound,
it sounds silly.
By the next day, Senator Cornyn, who's the head of the NRSC, was saying that his organization was not going to be spending any money on Republican primaries, which was the point of the New York 23 fight. And so on that front, it was a victory. I mean, of course they were disappointed that Hoffman lost, but the larger goal was attained.
Now, Rick Moran at Right Wing Nut House, who I believe was supportive of Hoffman, was still very critical of other conservative bloggers for attacking Newt Gingrich for being supportive of the Republican candidate, D.D.'s, I forget how to pronounce her last
name. Scazafaza, whatever.
Whoever she is, that woman.
D.D., we'll call her D.D.
basically say, how can you be so ideologically purist that you would drum out Newt Gingrich of all people, who's just trying to figure out how to construct a governing majority and actually win elections and not be a strictly a fringe regional party. I mean, is there any kind of soul searching that the Republican Party is still without a single Republican House member in the entire region of New England? Upstate New York's not New England, but it's in that vicinity. Is there any kind of check to say, hey, wait a second, maybe maybe Dee Dee was a bridge too far for us, but we need to find some other kind of sweet spot, because just having up a, you know, a Tea Party guy, that's not going to win every district in the country.
Well, two thoughts on that. You know, I never really blogged on Hoffman, I wanted to, but, you know, I talked to some people I know personally who were covering the race, and interviewed Hoffman. And they told me, you know, this guy's just not ready for prime time. He's not the real deal. And, you know, then after that, I read that, you know, the biggest paper in the district, the Waterton Daily Times or whatever it was, that, you know, Hoffman went in there and basically pleaded ignorance on all local issues. And you just cannot go into an editorial board meeting of the largest daily paper in the district. And you know, you can disagree with them on stuff, but you cannot just say, I have no idea what you're talking about when it comes to local issues.
Well, he didn't live in the district, correct?
And there's that. So, you know, I think the larger point here is that he was just a bad candidate, which on some level speaks to, you know, really what are the goals and, you know, dare we say confidence of the Club for Growth. You know, I think the larger movement, you know, the Rush Limbaughs, the Eric Erickson's, everyone else is very thankful to the Club for Growth for spending the money they did, raising the profile of this race, making this an issue and sending this message to the party establishment. But and Newt had a different point. Newt's point was more about the actual candidate. I remember seeing a post on the corner, I forget who wrote it, that said, you know, Newt had the right idea, he just picked the wrong candidate, as in he should have defended somebody against Tea Parters, but not Dee Dee. But on the same hand, I think the Tea Parters messed up, because Hoffman was not the candidate to stake your race to. This guy was not as good as Ned Lamont. Ned Lamont was ready for prime time. Ned Lamont was ready to go out there and defend the progressive values. And
I like Ned Lamont, but that's very charitable to Ned, I have to say. He was a little stiff. At first.
Yeah, well, there's...
I think he got his sea legs over time, but...
There's stiff, and then there's not going in front of the Hartford Current and saying, I have no idea what the needs of Connecticut
yes,
are.
Yes, do
you see the distinction I'm trying to make?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, John Henke at the Next Right had a bit of a... I mean, it's soul-searching, but sort of an introspective post at the Next Right, correct?
Yes. He said, what did New York 23 mean? And he had three bullet points. Doug Hoffman just won the Republican primary. The general election is next year. There are two broken, corrupt, arrogant political parties we need to defeat. We beat the Republicans established in 2009, will be the Democrats in 2010. And New York 23 is not really about conservatives versus moderates. It's about the establishment versus the movement.
Can you explain this to me?
Sure.
I have a hard time understanding this. You know, the Republican Party has been... as lockstep and recalcitrant in the era of Obama as a party could possibly be, where does the sense of it being kind of corrupt and useless in the conservative blogosphere coming from? I mean, what else could you ask of these people if you're trying to be ideologically pure?
Well, in the case of Scazzafazza, she, you know, did support the stimulus. In the case of the larger point of the Florida Senate race that's burgeoning on the horizon, Chris supported the stimulus. So,
but these would be like total outliers in the party. This wouldn't be someone who would be fast tracked to be minority whip. I mean, there are people in the Democratic Party on the fringes,
who don't agree
with the overall platform. But that's going to happen in any party.
A Senate seat is still a Senate seat. And you know, we'll touch on this. We'll touch on this a little bit later. But, you know, we still have people within the party like Johnny Isaacson who are sponsoring, you know, corporatist bailouts like this $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit, which, you know, are just not part of the low deficits, anti-market intervention feeling that the Tea Partiers have. So
but
there's just
all,
more work to be done.
Isolated examples. It's not endemic to the party leadership.
I would strongly disagree. The leadership in both the House and the Senate have kind of smiled on the Isaacson stuff, and I mean, in order for you actually have to advance arguments and redefine the party, which you know was Hinckley's larger point. I would say you have to choose specific issues like this. That's how
over
you redefine 95% yourself.
95% of the party opposes stimulus, oppose the health care bill. I think you might have a little bit more of a Republican breakaway on climate, but that still remains to be seen. It's still going to be the overwhelming majority that will be against it. It's not going to be the leadership. This isn't Bob Michael in the 80s, you know, having brandy with Tip O'Neill.
Right, but I think you're making my point, which is that there are some people that may be wavering on things like cap and trade. And what things like New York 23 shows is that, no, you guys better not.
Okay. It just seems like that the right can never be satisfied, no matter what. I mean, you're trying to attain 100% perfect ideological perfection, which is just not practical in a very large country in a two-party system.
Yeah, when you would read like the New York Times and Washington Post and all that coverage before the race, you would see three things mentioned at the top of every article, which was abortion, gay marriage, and Sarah Palin. And so that's how everyone tried to define the race. If Didi Scalzafasa was, anti-stimulus, anti-card check, but pro-gay marriage and pro-choice, this never would have happened. Club for Growth would never have gotten into this race. This was driven by small government economic populism. There is still tons of room in the Democratic Party for a big tent on social issues. But I think particularly...
They're big tent all over the place.
particularly in the aftermath of the Bush-TARP Medicare, highway bill, education, No Child Left Behind disaster, conservatives are trying to say, we went the big conservatism, big government route. That doesn't work, and so we really need to go clean on those type of issues.
Well, as you might expect, there was some consternation, I'd say, in the liberal blogosphere that the story of New York 23 didn't get enough attention, that the traditional media was all about Republican victories in New Jersey and Virginia, and the fact that Owens did beat a very celebrated conservative candidate in what had been a Republican district was not getting its just attention. Also, that John Garamendi, a more liberal person than Ellen Tauscher, special election in the East Bay of California.
Yeah, that story rightly got no attention. I'm from the next district over in Oakland. California 10 is a very liberal district. The fact that they elected a liberal there was a complete nothing burger.
Others might disagree. it's a district that went more left. He ran very strongly on public option. There's plenty of Tea Partiers in California. They exist. Tauscher was very much a very business-friendly Democrat for a long time. Pelosi, I could say upstate New York is more important because you gained a seat in the House. But I can't remember what blog post mentioned this. Excuse me. But there are anti-tax initiatives in Washington State and Maine, the Tabor proposals, that make it very, very difficult for states to raise additional tax revenue.
I will agree with you there. The tax issues in Washington and Maine and Southern California all were kind of bigger stories and more. I would unfortunately admit kind of more defeats for the kind of lower government low tax stuff.
So I think if you look at it all in one picture, so Digby was pointing out the stuff about Garamendi and upstate New York in particular. You had Nate Silver at 538 talk about the media was being way too simplistic in characterizing what independents want, because there are like eight different kinds of independents, and they don't all work in lockstep. It seems to me you have to take all the races together, and you get a very ideologically mixed picture. You don't really get a real break away from the Obama agenda or break towards, a break away from government activism or break against. It very much depends state by state, region by region. And the only thing I do see that seems to be trend-worthy is anti-incumbency. And this really speaks to, I think, another point you want to talk about Charlie Crist, running in Florida. You know, obviously, Corzine got beat down in New Jersey. He is far from the only governor dealing with depleted tax revenue and has no choice but to figure out how to and or raise taxes and cut services that are dragging down their popularities. It's true for Democrats like Deval Patrick in Massachusetts and Republicans like Schwarzenegger in California and Republicans like Charlie Crist in Florida. And so now Crist is having to do a little bit of a dance himself that's endearing himself to conservatives across the country.
I would kind of push back on that a little bit, in that, you know, the left is trying to have it both ways on this it's all about local issues, about nationalizing the election. If you look at, you know, what Ben Trivett at Fire Dog Lake said after the election, he was talking about specifically Virginia, and he wrote, "Unfortunately for us, the Deeds campaign freaked out and read these polls wrong over the summer. Instead of attempting to energize more young and minority voters to the polls to make the electorate more represented in Virginia, they began running a campaign targeted to treat people already planning to vote. Cray began bashing federal Democratic parties like Hackman Trade, healthcare reform, to appeal to conservatives that were ahead in the polls. And every time he did it, polls indicated that turnout shriveled even further among Democrats and progressive voters." And then Marcos had pretty much the same reaction. He said, "This is a base problem, and this is what the Democrats better take from tonight. If you abandon the Democratic principles in a bid for unnecessary bipartisanship, you will lose votes. If you water down reform in favor of Blue Dogs and their corporate benefactors, you will lose votes." So I think you have pretty much every people on both sides, both the conservatives and the progressives in the blogosphere, looking at the election results and saying, this means we need to double down ideologically.
Well, I had a similar post myself at ourfuture.org, looking at how both McDonnell in Virginia and Christie in New Jersey both got less votes than McCain did in those states in 2008. Whereas the Democrat got way less than Obama did in those states. And even the Maine gay marriage referendum, the anti-gay rights forces had a little bit less than McCain's vote total in 2008, and there was a massive drop-off from where Obama was in Maine and where the pro-gay rights forces were. Off-year elections tend to be very much about base mobilization. But I do think I do think there's a distinction between it's not quite doubling down. I don't think folks left are saying, hey, you should go as far to the left as humanly possible to win these things. But I think it's certainly the wrong lesson for Blue Dog Democrats, and I think that this narrative is being pushed in Politico and elsewhere today, that these Blue Dogs are having second thoughts about healthcare, second thoughts about passing a carbon cap. And that seems to me the wrong lesson. You want to be showing folks both in the progressive base and in the middle that you're doing something. Right now, I think there's a frustration in the middle. Things aren't happening. These promises aren't being followed through on, and they're not seeing benefits reaching their communities. And what happened in 1993 when Democrats lost New Jersey and Virginia and those Blue Dogs flinched from passing health care is the Blue Dogs that lost their races in 1994. They're much better off actually passing these things and trying to show they're delivering, get that progressive base juiced up, and then talk to independents, say, hey, look, we're actually doing something for you the way you want us to in 2008.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting reading. I just don't think that's what the progressives on the blogs are saying. They're saying we should use this in order to, you know, double down and pass card check and pass the public option and pass cap and trade.
I don't think all those things amount to all the stuff
that independents are very, very, you know, worried about.
I don't think those issues are akin to going as far to the left as humanly possible.
That would be where we disagree now, wouldn't it?
That may be. But I think it's definitely fair to say that there is some consternation in the broad middle of the electorate about what some of these things might do. You see conflicting numbers in polling data about public option. You generally see very high numbers of being supportive of a choice of a public option. That can get into the 70s. And then you see more skepticism about how well that it would actually work, whether people would actually want to take advantage of it. So there's that tension between wanting to see government do more and concern that government's going to do it well. And, you know, what progressives, I think, would largely say is you have to have some faith that once you pass these things, you're going to be able to assuage what concerns people do have in the middle about how well they work. And it's going to pay off for you come election day, as opposed to flinching from it and getting scared about it and then having to go to the voters with nothing come election day and just fostering more cynicism.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think it would be great for Republicans if the Democrats passed a public option that the public very soon discovered was, in fact, just a government-run insurance company that was only available to about 5% of Americans. And here, the rhetoric has been it's not government takeover, it's only available
to 5% of Americans. What's the damage?
Oh, well, the damage will be then that voters will be very upset and the Democrats will immediately try to open it up to everybody. Which is what's happening, our concerns, we're trying to say
people will be upset with you because you're not making this available and people want it. and that's being done to have these kind of bastardized compromises with these blue talks. So we're saying, hey, don't water down these bills and make them ineffective for short-term political reasons when you'll be better off in the long term just making the programs actually work well and be available to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you look at something like one of the last stumbling blocks in the House, you have, is this bill going to fund abortions or not? And we'll see if they're able to get by it. But I think if you're a blue dog and Nancy Pelosi's knocking on your door literally tonight because they're trying to vote on this thing by Saturday.
Right.
You have to say, you know, do I want to vote for a bill that allows the government to fund abortions? Or do these election results mean that I should stand a hard line and demand that it doesn't?
Well, I think we can see both in the Virginia race and in New York 23 that these social issues were not dominant. That is not what is on people's minds right now. What's on people's minds are jobs, costs. You know, the whole point of healthcare reform, and I know you disagree, is that healthcare reform is going to lower people's costs. The whole point, and to be a relief on businesses and help create jobs. There's talk, you know, Robert Reich.
I think that's true in a pro-choice area like New York 23, and in a rapidly becoming ambivalent and purple Virginia. But when you go to these blue dog districts, that you have lots of pro-choice Democrats. Whether or not the federal government is
pro-life Democrats,
whether or not the federal government is forcing you to pay for abortions is going to be a bit of a motivating factor.
Well, except that the government won't be forcing you to pay for abortions.
Well, that's what taxes are. Government will be forcing you to pay for abortions. That's what government funding of abortion is. It forces you through taxes to pay for abortion.
But that's not what the bill would do.
That's exactly what the bill does.
anywho. Did you have more blog posts you wanted to reference as far as Jersey and Virginia are concerned?
Just one more. It actually kind of touches back on New York 23 a little bit. And I have lots of positive things to say about Rush Limbaugh. And I have also said, particularly in his tone and sometimes in the jokes that he tells, that I think he does the larger movement some harm. But I thought there was a good comment in John Hinckley's post about what did New York 23 mean. And the guy was actually largely agreeing with Hinckley's post, but then he writes, a brief parenthetical remark, Rush did not help. His vulgar remarks about bestiality and rhinos and scazafaza did not pass unnoticed in our district. It was the content of a final newspaper editorial against Hoffman in a swing district that has a lot of traditional people. It went against the grain. Dede's support broke late for our Democrat, and while it may not have been the only reason, it sure didn't help. Rush does too dang much of this, playing the bad boy who really didn't say what you thought he said. He should stop it. He hurt the conservatives this time, and someone who has his ear should tell him. And as a Rush fan, I do think that's right. I listen to blogging heads most of the time when I'm working, and when I'm not listening to blogging heads, I'm usually listening to Rush. And
that explains oh so much.
And when he's on his live show, he runs these parodies online instead of the ads, and there's one in particular that most of them are funny. Most of them are making fun of Obama. I think they're hilarious, but there's one that I think is just very misogynistic, and I think there is an edge to Rush that he uses and is part of his persona. that is damaging to the conservative movement. And I do think when you are trying to run in places like New York 23, kind of more purpley areas, that, you know, even though Rush is great on the issues and you get lots of people fired up, you know, if he could just tone down, you know, this bestiality talk or tone down some of the more over-the-top stuff, he could be a much more value added to the movement than he currently is.
Are you allowed to say misogynistic in the Heritage Foundation?
I don't see why not.
Are you going to say heterosexist next? I mean, what kind of, what other buzzwords are you going to throw at me here?
I don't even know what heterosexist means.
Oh, you're from Berkeley, you know.
I'll figure it out later.
One other election-related thing I wanted to bring up, and it's not a specific blog post, but it's a Politico story, making a case that Twitter became a much more useful resource for election analysis on election night than cable TV was, which became completely bogged down with political hacks, just giving standard spin and talking points and no detached objective analysis of what's going on. And I found myself, I was in a situation where I couldn't watch cable TV, I was at an election night party, but I certainly found going on Twitter, getting a lot of real-time information and some interesting scuttlebutt reporting from various sources that were not the same kind of standard. I mean, you want to hear a little bit of spin. You want to hear what the parties are saying about it, but you don't want that to be utterly dominating of your news coverage, because that's not going to give you a real accurate picture of what's happening. And I wonder if there is a shift away from cable TV coverage. You know, CNN in particular had a terrible night, and CNN usually does very well on these on live events. That's usually their bread and butter. But it's been their bread and butter because they do real reporting on those things, or at least historically they did. And if they're just being the same kind of place for, you know, political professionals to spin away, why would you seek them out on election night? And why not just get it from Twitter if that's going to be very easily accessible?
Yeah, I mean, I actually ended up watching CNN until I went to bed. And it was largely because both Fox and MSNBC just stuck with their regular programming. It was election focused, but it was the same format. It wasn't like in 2008 when they went full bore, you know, we have reporters everywhere, we're going to be reporting what's going on. They just kind of stuck with their regular format, which is whereas CNN kind of went to their 2008 approach. But yeah, it was the same cast of characters, and it was very boring. But it was
the Bill Bennett,
right? Roland Martin, all those.
I mean, Martin at least is not a political professional. I mean, he has a political view, but he's not a paid person for a political party or a consulting firm in Washington.
That doesn't mean he said anything intelligent.
Ouch.
But yeah, no, I mean, you know, Twitter, of course, you know, you're able to choose who you're listening to. And if you're, you know, a political person, you're generally already going to have filtered out so that you're only listening to people's opinions who you think are smart and intelligent. So I think it stands to reason that, you know, all the work you put into identifying the right sources to be listening to on election night, you should be getting a better feed out of that personalized news channel than something that's supposed to be prepackaged for a large audience on CNN.
Well, I'll be curious in 2010 if that kind of dynamic forces cable TV executives to rethink how they approach these things. And I hope it does. I hope they recognize that, you know, the quality of their product, all this about the print media product declining in quality. I think cable TV needs to think about what they could be doing that actually would be of value added to
this question. I think CNN's already asking those questions.
I mean, most of the that debate has been seen as not being ideological enough to compete with the very fiery primetime schedules of MSNBC and Fox. And I certainly don't think that's what CNN should be gravitating towards. You know, they're trying to do it with Campbell Brown to say, let's have someone be opinionated but just be all over the map. And, you know, CNN's brand is quality journalism. And I was saying this to you before we started. All the time with CNN's ratings tanking, you know, NPR's ratings are up, and they're enormous. And I don't say this as an NPR booster, because I actually personally hate them and think they're I think they're an opiate on the liberal masses. But they I can say objectively they do a fair amount of quality journalism. I think better than CNN's journalism in many respects. And they're getting benefits from it. They have Morning Edition's 14 million people over the course of the week, which is on par or better than Rush Limbaugh. I think it's more than 30 million listen to NPR programming over the course of a given week, and that's all on the upswing.
Well, so these are,
there's a lesson of how to do this stuff well.
These are all great arguments why public broadcasting should not be funded by the government.
Or a lesson how people really enjoy the program that they get that's government funded.
Which could easily not be, and still survive very well.
That is what's breaking the bank, NPR. We wouldn't have a budget deficit if it wasn't for NPR.
It's the principle of the matter.
Of course, of course. So you also were interested in exploring a recent theme on in the conservative blogosphere that there needs to be more of an economic populist message on the right.
Yeah, this is some. These are, you know, kind of headlines I've been seeing pop up more and more. These aren't. I haven't seen it so much on blogs, which I think is kind of unfortunate. But I've seen a lot of libertarian, right-of-center authors kind of speaking to the same headlines. The one I'll start off with actually is a blog. Luigi Zingales, who's a professor at actually the Chicago Business School, wrote an article for first in Investors Business Daily, which Arnold Kling, who blogs at EconLog, picked up on, as well as Mark Toma, who's a big macro blogger from the left. And Luigi wrote for
Mark Toma's at Economist View.
Right. Luigi wrote in his Investors Business Daily piece, the Republican Party has to move from a pro-business strategy that defends the interests of the existing companies to a pro-market strategy that fosters open competition and freedom of entry. A pro-market party will fight tirelessly against letting firms become so big cannot be allowed to fail, since such firms may take risks that ordinary companies would never dream of. And before we get to what Mark Toma said in response, just to kind of list the other titles that I've seen along these lines, Joel Kotkin had a piece of Politico, GOP Needs Economic Populism. Peter Sudeman wrote an op-ed for Newsweek, The Anti-Corporate GOP, What Happened to the Party of Business Interests. And over at Reason, there's an article, Can It Be a Party for Capitalism? Free Market Populism is a Political Movement with Staying Power. So I think there is kind of a growing interest on the rightosphere for putting some more intellectual bones to the economic populism of the Tea Parties, which I think is a wonderful development.
Well, interesting you brought this up. If I may shill for my employers at Institute for America's Future, we just put on a conference last week with the Alliance of American Manufacturing, and we had a pretty heavy blog contingent covering it, and the whole thrust of the conference was we desperately need to be revving up our job creation engine, which has been in decline for several years, and I'm sure, maybe you and I agree to that extent. I'm sure we part ways on the specific solutions. And what the conference was trying to do was popularize the notion that we need to be having a real industrial policy again. We need to be investing in manufacturing. We need to have better policies that support growing manufacturing jobs and making things in America again. As well as having trade rules that are fair and don't create all these incentives to ship all those jobs offshore, not in a protectionist sense that it's sort of us against you, but in having a balanced global economy that lifts all boats in all countries. I mean, right now, China is very mercantilist.
So right, protectionism,
now,
but with a happy face.
We would say it's not protectionist. it's not an us against them. It's not protecting us against somebody else. It's saying let's have a global system. Where, I mean, many countries already do this now. I mean, China invests enormously in itself. We're not playing a game where everyone's playing the same rules right now. We need to recognize how what most of the world is doing and act accordingly. Otherwise, what we have now is a very imbalanced economy where China's doing all the manufacturing and the saving, and we're doing all the consuming and the spending. And that, as we've seen, is not a sustainable approach going forward. You need to have balanced economies internally, you need to have a balanced economy worldwide.
Right. I mean, it's like Tom Friedman said, if only we could be China for a day, we could get rid of democracy and institute a new energy policy and everything would be great.
Well, I don't think anyone's arguing for emulating China's political system. I'm sure Tuffy was speaking a little tongue-in-cheek and not being literal.
we'll read the article. We'll see how everyone can judge how tongue-in-cheek it was.
Not having read it, I'm quite confident he was not arguing for fascism. Jonah Goldberg would disagree.
That'd be communism, just for those keeping score.
Well, I would think China's government is much more like fascism. Anyway, but there's a lot of blogging on our site, ourfuture.org. Richard Trumka, the AFL-CIO, is one of the speakers of the conference, blogged there about why it's necessary to make things in America again. You had David Diane from Fire Dog Lake. David Diane, I'm sorry, always mispronounce his last name. Reporting on Congressman Rosa DeLauro's proposal for an infrastructure bank, which I did see in the Washington Post, I think might be being picked up again by the White House. Obama ran on it in the general election. They're trying to find ways to create jobs that don't add to the deficit. They feel hamstrung by that. An infrastructure bank is potentially a way to do that. So these ideas may start getting stronger currency. They haven't been the order of the day, as we've focused a lot on the more short-term stimulus and the health care and global warming bills, although global warming has potentially a big manufacturing component in it, depending on how they construct the bills. You could be doing a lot of investing in green technology in that legislation, which the House version does. We'll see how 2010 goes. As I said earlier in our segment, Robert Reich is pushing for a second stimulus very hard by saying, look, Blue Dogs, you're the guys who are going to lose if you don't start creating some jobs before 2010. You've pulled us back from the abyss. You averted a Great Depression by having a stimulus, but you haven't done enough to actually get the job engine, you know, cranked up again. If you have a jobless recovery, that's better than going into a depression, but it's not going to get you very far, you know, come election day.
Yeah, I think this is going to be interesting, because I think, you know, when you look at Mark Thoma's response, and again, Mark Thoma is a more progressive, kind of macroeconomist. But of course, you know, he kind of disagrees with you on a lot of that stuff. You know, he does not think we need a new industrial policy. And I think kind of more of the economic mindset on the left doesn't think we need that much stronger government intervention in the market. And so I think there is going to be a closer tie between the populism, pro-market populism of the right to say, you know, we do not need all this new government interference in order to create jobs.
If I
can just go ahead and finish.
Okay, can you summarize Thoma's argument? I did not read the push you sent me ahead of time.
No. Sure. I will go ahead and go through Thoma's response here. So this is Kling writing. In response to Luigi Zingales' article, Thoma argues in defense of the Democratic Party as the Jeffersonian Populist Party. He claims that Zingales' ideas, including school vouchers, are Democratic Party ideas. And now this is quoting Thoma. The general idea that some kids are disadvantaged by the education they receive has been a mainstay within the Democratic Party for a long time, and quite a few Democrats endorse vouchers as part of the solution, even breaking up teachers' unions in some cases. And then this is Kling in response. I think these two quotes illustrate how an economist becomes a partisan. Basically, you take an unrealistic, optimistic view of the policies of the propensities of your favorite party. I mean, Mark Thoma is telling us about a pro-voucher Democrats when the reality is that Democrats killed the D.C. school voucher program. There was even a story the other day about Obama's attorney general telling a D.C. councilman not to run an ad supporting vouchers. Thoma is fantasizing about a non-corporatist Democratic Party when today's Washington Post has a lead editorial on what I personally think is the worst abomination, the Chewmobile. And this is from the Post. We share the administration's fervent wish for a cleaner, greener vehicle fleet. All parties of the deal assure us that the site's proximity to transportation routes and other advantages, not politics, led to the Fisker decision to locate there. Just one question. If the Volt isn't commercially viable, why is Fisker's car? The company has not even described the vehicle publicly, except to say it's family-oriented and will cost about the same as the Volt. And so I think when you go into the weeds and you look at the specifics of this industrial policy, when you look at the green economy, you see that it is nothing but crony corporate capitalism up and down. Is that you have Al Gore making billions of dollars as a consultant getting deals for different power companies and sunlight companies. You have this Fisker company getting situated in Delaware. And because cap and trade and this green economy is going to be all run through Washington, the companies that are going to benefit from it are going to be the ones with the best lobbyists, the best accountants, and it's not going to be an engine for growth. It's going to be an engine for more transfer of wealth to those with, to those who are best politically connected.
I didn't get Thomas saying that in what you read to me.
Oh, well, you can. I'll definitely link to Thomas' post, but Thomas was saying that, largely agreeing with Zingales, that we need to have a more pro-market, not pro-business, pro-market policy in order to rebuild the economy. I can guarantee you Thomas is not going to be on board with you for all of the protectionism you guys have planned, or as you flat out said, that we need a new industrial policy. Those are not the type of policies that economists, even on the left, tend to embrace.
All I'm saying is, from what you read to me just there, I don't know if he was in sync with everything that you just said.
No, not I'm sure he's not in sync with everything I just said. But you know, he is definitely, you know, dreaming when he talks about a Democratic Party that's going to be able to enact pro-market education reforms. That's just never going to happen. There's only one party that can do that, and it's the Conservative Republican Party.
Well, education is a wholly separate subject than talking about how to invest in manufacturing.
Same principles.
Should we leave it there, sir?
At the 41-minute mark, I think that looks good.
Always good to talk to you, Con. I eagerly await you paying for my dinner.
Who knows, though? We may have to wait until February or March.
That may be, but I'm still quite confident that whenever it happens, there will be a full CBO score before the vote.
I always feel comfortable betting on the, shall we say, the expedient nature of politicians.
That may be. I think in this case, what's expedient as far as getting Blue Dogs to vote for the bill is going to be a full CBO score.
We shall see.
Talk to you soon. Talk-